Welcome to Confessions of a Cyber Psychologist. Today, I am chatting with Emma van der Scaif about video games and social capital. Emma is a PhD candidate in cyber psychology at the University of Sydney and also teaches two undergrad subjects, human development and innovation in e-health. I spoke to Emma a few weeks ago about social connectedness, and I'm so delighted to welcome her back on board. Hi, Emma. Welcome back.
Thank you so much. Happy to be back.
Emma, we have already covered your PhD research in social connectedness through video games, and today we're pivoting slightly to talk about your honours research into video games and social capital. What was it that started you on the journey into focusing on the social capital side of things in video games?
Absolutely. So thank you so much again for having me back. Really, really excited to get into it today. So social capital specifically, why I was interested, I guess. I was fascinated by having a think about how we can improve well-being. So, thinking about things like loneliness and isolation and the impact this is having on people. So, loneliness, of course, often leads to feelings of sadness and helplessness and also a reduced sense of purpose. And social isolation is also a significant, factor or, component to the onset and worsening of mental illness, particularly among vulnerable groups, like the elderly or different, particular groups of people. So that fascination is kind of what spurred me into thinking about, I won't say solutions, but different things that we can do to enhance our social connection with others and enhance social capital. So yeah, that's what sort of brought me to social capital and video games as well.
You mentioned during our initial chat on this topic that lots of people engage in online multiplayer gaming as a way to develop and maintain social capital. So can you talk a bit more about what social capital means and why people use gaming as a form of social capital?
Absolutely. So social capital is a term that sort of broadly refers to the networks of relationships among people in a particular society or in a particular group. So in sort of simpler terms, it's about the value that we derive from our social connections, whether that's, emotional support, access to resources, or a sense of belonging. So there are two main types of social capital that have been identified in the literature. One of them is bonding social capital, and the other one is bridging. So bonding refers to those strong ties that we share with close friends and family, and then bridging refers to those looser connections, so acquaintances or sort of brief encounters with other people. When it comes to gaming, particularly online multiplayer games, they serve as a really unique platform for building both types of social capital, actually, so both bonding and bridging. These games can be inherently social in the way that individuals play them. So they require those elements of collaboration, communication, teamwork, and players can form really deep bonds with team players as they work towards shared goals. And I guess what's fascinating is how gaming communities offer opportunities for bridging social capital specifically. So being able to connect people from all different walks of life in these virtual spaces and breaking down traditional barriers like geography, age, culture. And so you might, end up gaming and meeting someone from halfway across the world and developing a friendship as well with them. So we've also found that, things like social connection and even in the gaming space can help with things like referral to mental health support. So there's a lot of benefits to development of social capital in these spaces.
So in terms of bridging, so building a relationship with others, how would someone go about kind of a bridging type of an activity in the offline world, just to kind of relate it then back to how people do bridging in a gaming environment?
Absolutely. So there's loads of different ways that people might develop those sort of bridging connections. Things like, going to different sports leagues or, meeting people through university or in the workplace, all of those kind of incidental meetings, I should say, can be a way that you can develop some of those bridging increase bridging social capital.
Okay. So it's kind of like if you meet someone and you get on with them, or you think, oh, there's a bit of a friendship spark, or I really relate to this person, I will then go out of my way to potentially connect with them again. and make it obvious that I kind of like them, or maybe let's go out for a coffee, or let's meet up again, because I kind of, there's a bit of a connection. And then you go into the bonding stage of sharing stuff and building that relationship. So it's kind of like a stepped process. And that happens in the gaming world as well, I'm assuming, that people kind of team up with others. They recognize there's something that they quite like about a person, and then go about building that bond in an active way.
Absolutely. I love the way you put that in a way that wasn't binary, because it can feel a bit binary in the literature. So bridging versus bonding, but you gave a great example there of how, you know, you might meet someone and you might sort of go along that interim between meeting them and then getting to know them and developing some of those deeper connections to form those bonding social capital or form those relationships. So absolutely.
Yep. And I guess the kind of older generation don't think of it, gaming, as that kind of ability to connect people in that way. And I know for me, I'm not a gamer. And then I hear my friends' children talk about these friends they meet on the gaming world. And it kind of, for me, doesn't seem all that real, or it feels almost as though, how can you have that relationship with someone you've never met? But I suppose for me, thinking back to when I was a child, we had pen pals in Europe that we wrote to, and we formed an element of a connection, even though we never met each other. So I'm guessing in a similar way that we still create relationships with others, even though we've never met them, and can form a very strong bond with them, despite not having seen them in person.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's the case for, you know, the literature on, you know, online dating and things like in those spheres as well. But you're absolutely right. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that really strong, deep, meaningful connections can be formed through things like video games and online.
And we spoke during initial chat about the book Bowling Alone by Robert Putnam. Can you talk about how changes in work, family structure, age, suburban life, television, computers, women's roles, and other factors are kind of isolating us from each other? And that's kind of a direct quote from one of the reviews of the book. And outside of gaming, do you think there's an alternative way that young people are able to find a similar level of connectedness and social capital?
Absolutely. It's a very good question. Yeah, we did talk about the book Bowling Alone, which is fantastic. So it was obviously by Robert Putnam, and he developed this sort of analogy that had to do with bowling. So the book was published in 2000s, but he was looking back at the last kind of 50 years from the 1950s. And so he described this decline in social capital, and he sort of made this analogy that while bowling, the sport, was sort of growing in America, what wasn't growing was sort of leagues and teams. So people were doing this activity more and more in an isolated capacity. And so he raised some concerns about how that sort of individualism and that sort of getting away from community might be something that we should be conscious of in sort of modern times. So yeah, I quite like that analogy to sort of explain social capital and where it came from. And when we think about, you know, younger generations today, many of them, you know, play video games. They get to have some really fantastic and fascinating adaptations of developing relationships online. So, you know, a whole lot of ways that they can do that, like we mentioned before, you know, through sport, through a whole lot of other ways, social media platforms, Instagram, TikTok, Discord, we mentioned in our last conversation as well, community work, so volunteering, things like that, sports teams, creative workshops, any types of hobbies and experiences in that sort of capacity as well.
And I'm guessing most young people, they integrate offline and online into one space, whereas potentially the older generations who haven't grown up in a digital world separate them out as, that's online world, this is offline world, whereas younger people integrate them into one. So if they connect with someone offline or online, it makes no difference to them in terms of their connectedness or social capital. It's all one and the same.
It's a very, very interesting point. We do find that some people have sort of a clearer delineation of that online relationship versus their offline relationships. And then other people, like you mentioned, have less of that sort of binary components and have more of an element of, you know, just seeing my friends, and whether that's online or offline, those sort of things are a little bit less pronounced a little bit more blurred. But absolutely, absolutely. It can be delineating for some people and not for others.
Is it possibly, because you mentioned earlier about mental health and how that some gamers find it easier to talk to people in the online multiplayer games about mental health. Do you think that potentially they're more likely to reveal mental health issues to those who have not met them in person before versus those who they possibly know in person who might then know others who they know in person? So all what the question I'm trying to ask is, are people more open to talk about their mental health issues online to those they don't connect with offline versus revealing more about their mental health issues to those in an offline environment who may know them and judge them in a flesh form?
Absolutely, absolutely. It's a really, really good question, and it kind of depends on the individual. So some research has suggested that opening up about mental health for some people, it's really important that they feel like they're in a safe environment and with someone that they know and they feel really comfortable with. So that might be, you know, friends, family, people who, you know, they interact with on a daily basis. For others, like you sort of alluded to there, being able to have a chat to people who they don't know and sharing that, kind of like the online disinhibition effect, they don't feel like it's as scary, as nerve-wracking to be able to open up about some of those components. So that anonymity can be a really, really powerful tool to be able for them to open up and chat about things like mental health.
Yeah, so it is an individualistic thing rather than a most gamers only speak to those online about their mental health.
Absolutely, absolutely.
If you talk to most gamers, you get a kind of perspective on how they view the relationship with other gamers they spend a lot of time with. What is the general viewpoint of gamers when it comes to their online gaming friendships?
A very, very good question. There were a whole lot of themes that we sort of pulled out from our research, asking gamers about their perspectives on those relationships. A lot of them did identify that these relationships, though, were very meaningful to them. Their online friendships were built on these shared experiences and mutual goals and hours of collaborative play, and they really valued these relationships. Of course, there were some positives, and then we can also get into some of the negatives as well of things that they sort of brought up. So we alluded to a little bit earlier, but anonymity was one that some people really enjoyed. They thought it fostered a sense of psychological safety, which encouraged genuine reactions and really meaningful connections, while others didn't really partake in having that anonymity and didn't feel like that was important for them in terms of their psychological safety and their enjoyment of the game. A lot of participants let us know that they felt like it was an opportunity for them to be their really authentic selves. So this shared interest in gaming served as a common ground where they could sort of freely engage and interact with one another and really be themselves. We also found that, you know, structurally, it was quite an easy way of connecting so that they could, you know, jump on. It was fairly low barriers to entry in terms of meeting people or chatting with other people. They could really quickly form rapport with other people, and it was very flexible in the way that they could do it. So, you know, you're free for an hour after work, it's 10 to 11 p.m., and that's all the time you sort of had. You could absolutely jump on and engage with people at that time as well, which people really enjoyed. They also reported really, really deep friendships. So someone reported in the study that they, you know, their best man was someone that they met through gaming and built this amazing rapport with and really deep friendship. Other people sort of mentioned that, you know, for example, we had parents mention that this was a really nice bridge between them and their children. So they mentioned sort of a shared language that they could sort of chat and interact with that didn't have to do with, have you done homework or things like that. It was a really, really nice way of connecting that wasn't, in other sort of realms. They also reported really strong, long-lasting friendships, but not everyone did. And I think this comes to a really important point, was that not everyone's experience of gaming was the same. And that's obviously very valid. You know, some people say that they had really strong, long relationships with people, and others just jumped on because they thought it was really fun and they wanted to do it for 20 or 30 minutes. And they didn't really want to do it, to gain some of these deep social connectedness components. So they just did it to relax and connect with some people and then sort of disengaged and probably wouldn't chat to those people again. All very valid forms of engaging with others online.
I always have to bring it back to the kind of offline world of, it's similar if you're playing football, and that some people really get into it and build strong relationships, and then others just come for the game and then leave. And they don't want to build those strong relationships because they've got other stuff outside of that football game that is of greater interest to them. So it all depends on the uses and gratifications of why you're going into play and what kind of social capital you're looking to build. We spoke earlier about kind of mental health and conversations around mental health in the gaming world. But you also mentioned during our initial conversation that there are several older gamers who take a type of mentoring role of younger gamers. Can you talk a bit more about this?
Yeah, absolutely. So this was one of the interesting findings that were reported to us. So in online communities, it wasn't uncommon for these more senior members or more experienced players to take on a mentoring role when interacting with younger or less experienced players. This was sort of a dynamic and natural outcome of collaborative and supportive environments that gaming can offer individuals. So mentorship in gaming can take various forms, you know, teaching different kinds of gameplay mechanics. And people also had reported that more senior individuals could also offer life advice and support as well. So it wasn't just game specific, which was very interesting. So one of the primary ways that mentorship, I guess, sort of manifests in these is through shared knowledge. So, you know, experienced players guiding younger players by explaining strategies, navigating complex challenges, and also offering advice on their sort of skills. And we found, for example, a lot of individuals got to develop their skills like English, for example, if that wasn't their first language. So reported feeling more comfortable speaking English and being able to sort of practice it in this environment, which was really, really cool. So, you know, obviously it's a very dynamic thing, mentoring, and it can extend beyond the game itself to those communication skills, like I said, cultural understanding, or even sort of navigating life's challenges.
That's fascinating, because we often talk about young people just as they violent video games, and therefore they're the ones who become violent. But actually, we don't always consider these positive elements of they're being mentored and they're learning a new language and they are building friendships and they're being supported. And it's not just about the game, although there is some element of escapism and some element of enjoyment in the process, but there's so many of these personal and life skills benefits that a lot of players get from spending time with others in a multiplayer online game.
Absolutely. And it's, you know, to your point, it wasn't a passive sort of thing, you know, oh, I picked up English or I've got skills in this particular area. These were individuals that rated these as sort of the best things that they got out of gaming. So really active engagement in these type of elements, which is really, really awesome.
And one of the upsides of online multiplayer games is exactly that players get to meet and form friendships with diverse communities across the globe. What value do you think there is in this type of relationship building, not just in about learning a new language or perfecting their language or the mental health or the coaching side of it? What other value do people get from building these types of international relationships?
Absolutely. Another good question. So the diversity, obviously, inherent in these online gaming communities was reported to significantly enhance the social experience, according to the participants. They really enjoyed being able to meet and to interact with people from across the globe and learn about cultures that they identified as things that they weren't sure of beforehand. So the participants came from a wide range of sort of cultural and socioeconomic backgrounds, and they reported that they really enjoyed this sort of cross-cultural exchange and global friendships. So this contributed to their self positively in the way that they were able to develop things like self-esteem and all of these kind of positive components. And also broadened their perspectives and fostered like an inclusive and really mutually respectful environment. Though this wasn't always the case, and I think we'll talk a little bit later about how this can sort of go awry. But the potential for this to be really beneficial in the way of meeting and interacting with people from across sort of different areas of the globe was reported to be something that they really enjoyed.
We've really mentioned about online games being a form of escapism, and people and often talk about that element of gaming. And often as academics, we speak about gaming as one of the positive things is escapism. That's okay, because you can also say that about a number of offline games and activities. But what is it about the escape that gaming provides that is so appealing to so many people?
Absolutely. So the escape or escapism is referring to sort of the act of seeking relief from the challenges and stresses from daily life through immersive activities. And like you alluded to, people can do this in a number of ways, reading books, doing a whole lot of other activities, hobbies, crochet, knitting, all these types of things are, you know, hobbies that might be fulfilling these sort of escapist goals. Gaming specifically though, it's a really immersive environment with rich narratives and engaging gameplay that provide individuals a really sort of active way to be able to disconnect. That sounds sort of ironic, but an active way that they can disconnect and focus on something enjoyable and stimulating. So, you know, there's other passive forms, TV, reading, gaming, but being active in this has shown to enhance that sense of escape. So for many gamers, escapism provides not only avoidance, but an ability to sort of recharge and a valuable sort of outlet for stress as well. But we know that, you know, that can be really beneficial. It may not be beneficial when they're avoiding sort of day-to-day activities and important components of life outside of the video game. So there is absolutely that discussion to be had. But yes, escapism can be really beneficial for people to sort of disconnect and recharge as well.
I think you're right. Is that there is an element of needing to reboot parts of our brain, because we obviously use different parts of our brain for different activities. And as you're chatting, I was thinking, actually, I do that with audiobooks. So I've got whirly brain and I can't stop thinking about something and I really need to kind of have a bit of a break from that, I put an audiobook on, because that stops that thinking side of the brain and gets me into the listening side of the brain. And then I can just re-energize and then I'll come back to whatever I was thinking about with a whole different perspective. So I have my own, I've got many forms of escapism, but that's one of mine. And it's a kind of a socially acceptable way to escape. Whereas gaming and multiplayer online games isn't socially currently the acceptable way to escape. But we all need to kind of recognize that this is one element rather than just really bad.
Absolutely, absolutely. It can be really, really fulfilling to be able to take a step back. And like you were saying with your audiobook, sometimes, you know, having a bit of a brain break and not thinking about something and then coming back to it might give you a little bit more perspective or you know, maybe you meet people and you have a chat and you can sort of chat about your problems and then come back to whatever you were ruminating about before with a new perspective and maybe a new idea, which can be really beneficial.
I like that term, a brain break. I need to give my brain a break from stuff. Emma, we all know that there's some downsides to gaming, which you kind of alluded to earlier, including bullying and grooming. But what are some of the other negative social elements in the gaming environment?
Yeah, absolutely. There were definitely some really key negative components that individuals reported in gaming. And I guess I'll talk about the biggest three that we found. So the first one was the female gamer experience. So the gaming environment can be particularly challenging for female gamers. We know this. This is fairly, unfortunately, fairly well documented. And they often face sort of gender-based discrimination in what has been traditionally a male-dominated space. Though we know from demographic information that females are picking up gaming quite significantly as well. So these challenges really included some really nasty derogatory comments, dismissive attitudes, and outright hostility, which is really unfortunate. So they create barriers to fostering that social connectedness and increasing that social capital that we're sort of aiming for in those positive elements of gaming, and can make it really difficult for females to feel accepted or respected in certain gaming communities. We found that supportive female friends can act as sort of protective factors against things like that, though it's very well documented that the persistence of sexism must be addressed moving forward in these spaces. So that's one. So the female gaming experience. Another one is toxicity and harmful behaviors. So toxic behavior was reported quite significantly as something that many people in the gaming community faced. So this can manifest as verbal abuse, unsportsmanlike conduct, or outright hostility as well. And this doesn't need to be a particular gender, can be across genders as well. So individuals can exploit that anonymity that we talked about could be a really beneficial thing, but also could sort of pave the way to for people to feel more comfortable engaging in aggressive or harmful behaviors that they might not have been if their face and name and information was associated with it. So such environments make it challenging for players to maintain sort of those positive gaming experiences, and is something that the community is trying to and will continue to try and address as well. The third thing was racism. So this was another sort of deeply troubling issue in many online communities. Again, offensive language, derogatory name calling, discriminatory attitudes. Again, that anonymity factor might play into it as well in terms of people feeling comfortable making those kinds of comments. And again, it just harms the potential for gaming to foster those sort of positive connections across populations. And I know I mentioned it last time, but it would be remiss of me not to mention it this time. The Safe in Our World organization, if you're listening to this and you're thinking, oh my goodness, that, you know, sounds really awful, and it absolutely is. It's a fantastic organization, Safe in Our World, that is doing a lot of work to try and help in this space to address some of those really negative components of gaming, and to try and empower people to speak up and feel really empowered to play games and do it really in a positive way.
Thank you for that, Emma. That's awesome. So around the element of social capital and gaming and social capital, what is the most important question I haven't asked you yet?
A good question. Maybe a question that as I was thinking about this was sort of the future of what this research might look like, and thinking about the new technologies, I guess, that are coming out and how that might impact social capital. So maybe in terms of having to think about what that would involve, you know, gaming is poised to play a really increasingly significant role in shaping social capital in the future, particularly as technology, you know, develops. So we have virtual reality, AI, augmented reality, all of these types of really immersive behaviors are starting to, or immersive technologies are starting to be incorporated in things like the gaming environment. So, you know, unprecedented levels of immersion and social presence in these new technologies. And it could potentially make games more engaging and more enjoyable. So virtual reality allows individuals to interact with avatars and shared virtual spaces. This could even further mimic those real life interactions. And so like we were talking about earlier, that blurring that line between online and offline, potentially even further. So as these interactions, you know, between individuals change, it will definitely be interesting to see how things change. So authenticity and also social capital, and how that those relationships change and develop as the technology changes and develops as well. So definitely watch this space. A lot of amazing researchers doing some really cool things in terms of researching this area. And yeah, it'll be fascinating to see how as technology evolves, our understanding of forming relationships changes and differs as well.
That is something to watch out for. Watch the space. And Emma, in our last podcast chat, you mentioned the book Issues and Debates in Cyberpsychology by Professor Linda Kay. And we've spoken in this podcast about bowling alone. Do you have any other favorite cyberpsychology related book that you would like to recommend to others to read?
Absolutely. So in fact, I would love to recommend Bowling Alone. And then also there's a Bowling Alone book that was released, particularly looking at the text and how it sort of applies to more modern contexts. So Bowling Alone, The Collapse and Revival of American Community. If you haven't had a read of it, I know it's not particularly cyber psychology related, but probably very interesting for anyone who enjoyed this chat. Would definitely recommend having a look out for it and having a read if you're interested as well. Fantastic analogy, very interesting work by sociologist Robert Putnam, and very interesting in terms of its application to modern contexts and to things, you know, related to cyber psychology and online spaces as well.
Thank you very much for that. I think one of the great things about looking at other areas of psychology is how we then, as a cyber psychologist, pull that into the world of cyber psychology and say, okay, this offline world, or this offline theory actually relates to the online world in this way, or digital technology in this way. And it gives us a fresh perspective of how we can relate to behaviors online. So thank you very much for that.
Awesome. Thank you.
Emma, thank you so much for joining me on Confessions of a Cyber Psychologist. It was fabulous to catch up with you again. And I hope that we get to chat again in the future. And I look forward to continuing to find out more about what's coming out of your research.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for having me.